All right, welcome to walkthrough 4. I am Kato for the evening, and the problem set of this week is Sudoku. So how many of you guys have been to these walkthroughs before? Okay, so this is like the walkthrough crowd for the most part. So a bunch of you all are tuning in remotely, but you have no say in what we're about to cover. What have you found most helpful with these walkthroughs so that we can focus appropriately beyond being told what to do? What's useful? Looking at source code, PDF? No? Okay. All right. Good thing I came prepared. So I think this problem set's a lot of fun. It's the first time the course has used this particular problem set, and it's meant to build on the ideas of the game of 15, which was the first time we supplied you guys with a code framework, some fills in the blank, so to speak, and your task there was to get the essence of the game up and running. And here, too, is that the aim, but you've been given much more code, and dare say more interesting code, because this program can ultimately do more, at least in terms of its interface. So one of the neat things about this problem set is that we're introducing a library called ncurses. So much like you've used the standard IO library, the standard library itself, the math library, perhaps the crypt library, similarly is there this library called ncurses, new curses, the successor to something called curses a few years ago. And with curses, can you actually manipulate your screen a little with a more sophistication? So in the game of 15, you guys would print out the game board just by calling printf a whole bunch of times. And even though we had that funky ANSI escape sequence that had the effect of clearing the screen and giving the illusion that there was animation going on, really all you were doing was erasing the whole screen and then redrawing the whole thing, the board, again and again. So if you were actually on a really slow connection, like a really slow dial-up connection, you would actually see that refresh happening a lot less smoothly. So we were kind of mimicking the idea of animation, but in not a very versatile way, definitely in an inefficient way. What's neat about ncurses is that starting with this problem set, you can model each of the characters on your screen as an individually addressable location. And that's just a fancy way of saying you can update any character on the screen without touching any of the other characters. And that gives you a lot more flexibility. So a typical terminal window, this is a PuTTY instance, and the typical terminal window is how many characters by how many characters? Yeah, like 80 by 24 by default was just kind of the way things were in yesteryear, and most of these programs like PuTTY give you that size window by default. You can enlarge it, as I have here, to fill the screen, but for the most part, that's the standard size. What's useful about the framework, the code we've provided you guys with, is that it handles some of these lower level details that can actually take a bunch of time to get right. For instance, the resizing of a window certainly doesn't work very nicely if the window gets smaller than is expected by the game, but if you actually have a larger monitor than I'm able to project here, you can blow this thing up to fill your screen, even if you have a 30-inch LCD, and everything will nicely resize such that the game will stay centered in the middle of the board and everything will continue working. And that's sort of non-trivial without something like ncurses. For instance, consider Game of 15. We kind of ignored that detail by just making sure the whole board was sort of all the way to the left and all the way to the top, which kind of just avoided that issue altogether. And clearly, can you do things like colors perhaps a bit more easily? And you can finally allow the user to have a cursor, which is certainly a feature that's more familiar to current programs. So in short, it should be a lot of fun, I think, and you'll actually have a working game that you can play yourselves or even drag a roommate over to your computer and have them play some noob or some leet game. So that's sort of the overarching theme of the problem set. Why don't I go ahead and pull up the PDF and get us started as to where you should begin and what you should care about. So first of all, let me introduce you to this picture. If you've been doing standard editions thus far, you've been using nice.fas.harvard.edu, which is a whole bunch of Linux servers in the basement of the Science Center. In front of them is this thing called a load balancer, which is a semi-intelligent device that takes incoming SSH requests in and then sends you sort of pseudo-randomly to a machine behind it that you actually do your work on. And all of you guys have home directories on FAS's servers, and via a protocol called NFS, Network File Share or System, are you able to see your home directories on any one of those boxes. So we've mimicked the same idea moving forward, and probably for this problem set and every remaining problem set, we're not going to return to FAS, but instead are going to do everything in this cloud of Amazon. So what we have here is a depiction that I showed in class that if this is little old you at your laptop here at Harvard, you have some kind of internet connection to the internet. In turn, the internet somewhere firmware on it has a firewall owned by Amazon.com. And then behind that is a whole bunch of hardware that Amazon owns, servers and a data center somewhere in the Midwest or on the East Coast. We have created virtual machines. And by that, I mean we've taken sort of one of their super fancy computers. They have chopped it up for us into multiple smaller computers. So they might have a computer with 16 CPUs. They'll give us two of those CPUs, and they'll give us, say, 1/16 of the amount of RAM on the computer. And then we have the illusion of having our own Linux server, even though it's physically on the same box as some other people whom we don't even know. But what this allows us to do is to create these back-end virtual machines and to kill these back-end virtual machines based on how the problem set is going. So Glenn and Cato and I have been keeping an eye on sort of the underlying logs on these systems just to see what people are doing, how many CPU resources they're using, and if we find that the machine's starting to slow down because there's a lot of people on it at once, we literally are able to just type a few commands and these two back-end virtual machines can become three or four or five. And right now, we currently have four back-end virtual machines and one front-end. And the front-end is just sort of our fancy equivalent of one of those home routers you guys probably have at home that at least share an internet connection among a bunch of computers. So this is to say, when you start this problem set, FAS or nice.fas.harvard.edu is no more, because instead what you're going to want to do is go to the courses website, you can log in ultimately, but as the problem set says, you're going to want to go to /me. And if you go to /me after logging in, and I can't quite do it because I have a staff account and not a student account. Can we show you this? Will that work? So what you'll see when you log in with a student account, for instance your own, log in with your FAS account, lest you run into a chicken and the egg problem. Can't log in with your cloud account until you know what the password is. Once you go to this /me page, you'll be told your cloud.cs50.net username is such and such. It's going to be identical to your FAS username, and you're going to be told what your initial password is. And it's going to be a long, annoying thing to remember, but the first time you log in with it, you'll be able to change it via a command that's specified in the problem set. This now will be useful information because henceforth you're going to want to use, how many of you use PuTTY? Okay, Secure CRT? Terminal on a Mac? All right, so pretty much everything. Whatever you've been doing to use PuTTY, Secure CRT, or Terminal, keep doing it, but substitute literally the phrase cloud.cs50.net anywhere you've been typing nice.fas.harvard.edu. Those of you with Secure CRT, though, who had to configure it, or rather, who downloaded, installed it, and it just kind of worked because FAS pre-configured it for you, all you're going to want to do to get started, if you're not quite sure how to configure it with a different address altogether, is go to the course website under Resources, go to the SSH link under How to SSH to nice.fas.harvard.edu using Secure CRT. And even though this handout is clearly meant for SSHing to NICE, literally can you follow its steps, swap in cloud.cs50.net and create a new link when you fire up the program that just works for the cloud. So just post on the bulletin board if you have questions. But if you follow these directions and all these screenshots, it's very easy. You do it once. You never have to deal with it again. So any questions on these sort of this backdrop? Anything at all? No? Okay, and for those who came in late, no one is going to dare walk in front of the camera to get more candy, so why don't we put this up over here? All right, so let's forge ahead and see where this leads us. Okay, so number one in the problem, so number zero is all about Amazon.com and reading up, if you so choose, about virtual machines and what they are. We'll talk about them a bit more later in the course. Number one simply has you get your username and password via the URL I just mentioned. Number two actually tells you to SSH to cloud.cs50.net and to type a relatively familiar set of commands that copies the distribution code into your own directory. So I'm going to go ahead and do this so I have something to play with myself. I'm going to go ahead and use PuTTY. I'm going to use my Mailin account. And let's see, I'm going to do copy tilde CS50 pub distributions pset4. These steps are in the problem set, but I've made a pset4 directory. I'm going to do a copy CS50 pub distributions pset4 star to grab everything, dot, and that's going to go ahead and have no apparent effect until I type ls, and there are the files that I've copied over. And incidentally, because cloud.cs50.net is only for CS50's purposes. We're not having you bother creating an extra CS50 directory, since presumably the only stuff you're going to have in here is for CS50. So we've got a pset4 directory, and it looks like five files. So makefile is at least a type of file that's probably familiar. The Sudoku files are twofold, a C file and an H file. And then these bin files, leet.bin and noob.bin. So actually embedded in those two files are 1,000 of each types of Sudoku boards, so that there's 1,000 different games you, your roommates, whomever, can play. So it's not just the same board you're playing with the entire time. So just adds a bit of novelty to it. So let's see what's next. So that question gets us set up there. I suppose I should make this plug here. So as some courses do, at least the courses in which you'd actually be inclined to say you took the course, we're going to set up shop on the internet with, thanks to a website called cafepress.com. It's actually a really neat site. You go, you upload a few JPEGs of like your logos and whatnot, and henceforth will CS50 students be able to download CS50 t-shirts and mugs and other silly, stupid things that are nonetheless perhaps kind of fun to have. So if you're interested in submitting possible designs for such things, there is your opportunity. So more on that to come. Jansu, I think, is terrified that we're gonna end up having a whole bunch of t-shirts with her picture on them. So, well, this is a tough crowd. All right. So, now we dive into the Sudoku part. So, quick question. How many of you have actually played Sudoku before? Okay, so almost all of you. So I'll just point out two techniques to keep in mind, at least if you've not sort of formally thought about how you've been playing the game, if you have in fact played it before. So here's a sample board. This is a fairly easy one. And the goal of Sudoku, for those unfamiliar, is to fill this entire grid with numbers, but only the numbers from 1 to 9. And the goal is to make sure that every column, every row, and every 3x3 box that's boxed in with these thicker lines contains all of the numbers from 1 to 9 and once and only once. So fairly straightforward. And there are certain tricks that you can bear in mind if you're doing this on paper pencil. So for instance, one of the most typical approaches to tackling Sudoku, which is useful to bear in mind once you start to program the game, because you have to think about how you're going to implement this game, are certain tricks. So let's focus for a moment on the center box, only because I glanced at it, and you know what? Looks like there's, what, 5 numbers in there? That's only 4. Maybe there's sort of enough hints embedded in that box that I can figure out, infer what some other number would be. Whereas this guy, with just one number, probably a little harder to start from scratch and figure out what else should go in there. There's just too many options. So let's focus on the sort of lowest hanging fruit. The middle box, colored in gray, let's see, it has a number 1, it has a number 2, but it's obviously missing a number 3. So let's ask ourselves, where can you put 3? Well, generally, the at least human approach to this game involves scanning from left to right, top to bottom, glancing in the box and seeing where it can't go, for instance, or where it can go. So let's take a look at, okay, no wooden stick, so we'll use the technology. So where can it go? So can it go in this location here? All right, so no, because, again, every row has to contain every number, but only once. And so this doesn't work because 3 is already here. So that guy is out. So he can't go. He's not going to be able to go there. Where else? What about this guy here? Well, similarly, no, that's no good because there's a 3 to the left of it. Similarly, can it not go here because there's a 3 in that same row? And so by process of elimination, it looks like 3 has to go in this box here. And so I can go ahead and fill in that blank. And voila, now I've got 6 out of the 9 possible values as well. So one trick there, again, to sort of summarize what we did. Let me ask you what we did algorithmically. How did I go about figuring out where 3 can go? Okay, so yeah, I pretty much crossed out where it couldn't go. I considered iteratively all the possible blank spots and ultimately decided that there's only one possible place to go. Now, though I'm asking this question here, realize that the purpose of the problem set is for you to empower a user to play this game. So you're not going to be implementing a computerized solver. So this same algorithm that we've talked through briefly verbally here isn't actually something you have to code, but what you will have to code is you will have to determine through code whether or not the user has actually won, which is actually, dare say, a little simpler because you just have to check that all of those constraints are met. One number of every in every row, column, and three by three box. But let's take a look at just one other idea behind the game for those tuning in at home, perhaps, who've not played. So what I did here was I asked myself, all right, you know what? I see a bunch of nines throughout the puzzle. Where could 9 not go based on these constraints that 9 can only appear once in a row, column, or three-letter box? And even though it's not obvious at first glance what I did here, I pretty much looked at every 9 in the picture, for instance, this guy up here, and I decided, you know what? 9 cannot go anywhere in that column because there's already one, and so I shaded in gray everything for clarity. 9 cannot go here either. 9 cannot go here either. 9 can't go here. 9 cannot go where else? Where else can 9 not go? Two rows up. Right here? So 9 can't go here. 9's also in this box here, which means it can't go in this box here. It can't go here, here, or here. And so if I continue that train of logic, I'll just clean it up here. It's not clear where else 9 can go, but at least in the middle, once I shaded in all the boxes that I knew 9 could not go, it immediately jumps out at you that the only place 9 can go in that center box is in the middle left-hand box. And so I can proceed to fill that in, and I've chipped away at the puzzle further. So that's really all Sudoku is, at least for the neophytes, or at least for the relatively easier levels. And we point you to Wikipedia, a couple articles, if you're curious as to more sophisticated techniques, because certainly the leap boards, if you sort of get into this and start playing it yourself, there's certain tricks that will help you figure out the game's puzzles that actually are trickier to do on, say, a blinking prompt like this. Because if you don't have the ability to for instance, mark little notes to yourself, essentially, in the boxes. You don't have as many ways as remembering what can and can't go elsewhere, but the computerized version should lend itself nicely to the new boards, at least. So, with that said, that's the quick refresher on Sudoku, and ultimately, to be clear, the point is to get the board to look like this, and this is the type of configuration that your program, ultimately, will have to check for validity. Okay, so number 6 in the PDF simply talks you through or points you at 48 possible Sudoku games that we printed at the back of the PDF if you want to just kind of procrastinate during the week. And now in number 7 is where you dive into the actual code. So number 7 starts to walk you through a quick written tutorial as to what ncurses is. And again, ncurses is a library, whole bunch of functions that other people wrote for you that allow you to create graphical user interfaces, simple ones. There's really no mice movements, or though there can be. There is not drop-down menus necessarily, but at least it's sexier than, say, the game of 15 was. So what this relatively long problem walks you through is the process of actually building the game for the first time. So I'm playing the solution here, which was made by Sanjay, and notice or realize that this solution has features that are only optional in the standard edition itself, but Sanjay went ahead and implemented all of the optional features, even though you have the choice of optional features to actually implement. For instance, he has this feature where if you hit T, it shows you the timer for how long you've actually been playing this game, which is actually good motivation if you're trying to improve at the game. But that is just optional. But that hints at the kinds of things you can do with ncurses. You can turn on a timer in some arbitrary location without affecting the rest of the screen. But once I've copied in my code here, how am I going to go about building the Sudoku code for the first time? What do I do? Yeah, so make for the pretty much is your friend at this point. I could sort of forget about that for a moment and say, all right, well, it's GCC. The file is called sudoku.c. I want to output a file called Sudoku. Let's try that. Whoa, lots of errors. So you've probably seen errors like this before. Why did I get them? Yeah, so you need to specify to GCC that you want to use or link in a specific library. So it's one thing at the top of your code to say sharp include ncurses, which is in fact one of the first lines in the file. If we scroll here, notice that one of the very first inclusion lines is this ncurses.h library. But much like you have to include something at the command line too for the math library or the crypt library or CS50's library, similarly, do you have to run GCC with -l ncurses, thereby telling GCC that when it comes time to integrate functions called like mvaddString and mvaddchar and getchar, all of these ncurses specific functions, what you're telling GCC is to link in some file, some .o file that other people wrote for you that is installed in some special location on the Linux box. So this makes the compiler happy. But as you proposed first, by far these days the easier approach is just to write make, and apparently it's already up to date because it's clean, or it was just built. But remember, make clean, well, because of a command we've put in the make file, it gets rid of all that stuff. So if I try running Sudoku now, it won't in fact work because it's gone. But if I do in fact type make, notice that it outputted these things for me. So a quick note as to what else this make file does, or a quick review. What does this flag do? -g gdb. What's that? Yeah, so this enables debugging of your binary. And it specifically, it tells GCC to add some bulk to your program, like add some more zeros and ones to it to facilitate debugging. So little hints like more symbol names, like more names of functions and variables, things that the computer doesn't care about. Who cares if you call a variable foo or bar? But you, the human, might actually care about what those variables were called so that you can actually walk through the code and see what's going on. So without that, it becomes much harder to debug things with GDB. With it, that facilitates it. The -std equals C99 just means use the newer version of C, and that sort of gets tiresome to type yourself, so we include it automatically. So -w error is actually a new flag that we've added. You actually had another -W flag in your previous make file. What was that? Any recollection? Yeah, so it was wall or -wall or wall. And what that flag does is it says show the user, show the student all possible warnings. So even if your code is still going to work just fine, if there's any red flags, anything worrisome in it, we had the wall flag on so that you would be warned. And the idea being you should really go fix those warnings, because only if you really know what you're doing should you turn a blind eye to them. And certainly at this point in the course, probably best to sort of trust that the compiler knows a bit more than most of us at this point. So we went one step further here, really to raise the bar in terms of the quality of code this time, and we enabled WError. And what this does is it makes what used to be a warning into an error. So your code simply won't compile until you go deal with whatever the problem actually is. And this is because GCC can be a little forgiving. So especially now that we're talking about pointers, and pointers, for instance, are really just numbers or integers, you can kind of treat them in the wrong way, but the compiler will let you do it because it assumes maybe you really do know what you're doing. But again, sort of the first time through this type of code, best to assume that the compiler is in fact catching potential bugs in one's code. So that's going to raise the bar in the sense that it's going to pester you more to fix whatever problems are in your code. So it's probably a good thing. The rest of this is familiar. So this is output a file called that. Here's the file to actually compile, and here's the library that you want to use. So once I have this built, we'll see a Sudoku file highlighted in green with an asterisk, just meaning it's executable. I'll go ahead and run Sudoku in my working directory, and it seems that it doesn't run out of the box. This is sort of somewhat cryptic syntax for saying that really the usage for this program is as follows. Type the name of the program, followed by the word noob or leet, followed by optionally, is what square brackets mean in Linux, a number. And the idea here is that of the 1,024 new boards, you can actually specify which one you want, 0, 1, 2, dot, 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 1023. And it will pull up that specific board. This is useful so that if you're trying to test your code and you just stumbled across some bug, for instance, a number is not behaving as it should, kind of annoying if only one out of 1,000 times do you actually see that bug again. This way you can force the program to run the same board for you, even if you don't care about playing, but actually seeing the same issue again. So just note, just to be consistent with silly conventions these days, noob is actually two zeros. This is not an O, and these are two threes preceded by an L. Elite and newbie is the connotation. So let's go ahead and run noob. And just to be clear, let's go ahead and run the zeroth board. So notice I'm playing noob number zero. So this board will always look like this if I run that command. And notice, unfortunately, that I can't do anything. So at the moment, I'm hitting up, down, left, right, nothing at all is happening. Because that's because we have provided you with the code framework for this game. We've provided you with all of that automatic window resizing code. Clearly, we've set up some colors. And we've implemented three commands: a new game, restart game, the current game, and quit the game. So quit the game really didn't take all that much effort to implement. Bam, program goes away. And notice we do clear the screen so that there aren't remnants of the screen that kind of have scrolled up. If we run instead new game, notice that the board we're playing changes pseudo randomly. The idea being if the user gets tired of this game, you can hit N and start a new one. R, by contrast, nothing seems to be happening, but that's because you can't really play the game yet. You can't change the board. R clears all of your moves and shows you the original board again if you kind of screw up and want to start over. But that's it. That's all the game does. So what the problem set next does in this number 7 and beyond is walks you through not only the interface, which we just did verbally, but also now what's going on inside the files. And fortunately, there's really only two files in this problem set you have to care about. In leet.bin and noob.bin, it's just a bunch of zeros and ones. Useful for the game, but nothing you have to really care about. So it's only with problem set 5 that we'll start talking about file I/O, file input and output. For now, you can just kind of accept that someone else, us, have written the file reading code to load those boards from disk, and we'll get back to that with the next problem set. But there is one command we suggest you run. This is mentioned in this part of the problem set. We tell you to run a command that we'll use again for problem set 5, though not dwell on it here, xxd. Is what's called a hex editor. It's a program that shows you the contents of files, not like nano, but rather it dumps them in binary form or hexadecimal form or decimal form. So if I run it in binary form and run it on noob.bin, those are all of the zeros and ones inside of this file called noob.bin. So just to be clear as to what's going on here, there's a lot of stuff. This is 1,024 boards, but how many numbers are on a given board, maximally? So 81. So what this really is 81 times 1,024, but we used ints to represent each of those 81 cells. So that's 32 bits, 32 ones and zeros, times 81 times 1,024, and that's why a whole bunch of stuff just scrolled past. And the very simple format we chose is as follows. What was the command a while back that I can use to show only a page full at a time? Any recollection? So you can pipe one program to another. You did this for the pseudo-random number stuff, generating numbers. So you can send this program's output to another program's input. One such program is more. And this gives you one page at a time. So what this is the very first chunk of bits from this file. And it looks like 1, 2, 3, 4. So the first set of the first four sets of 8 bits, 1, 2, 3, 4 are actually laid out in this funky way. So this is a 32-bit integer, and it happens to represent the number. Looks big, right? If it's 32 bits, it's pretty wide. But it turns out that most computers today are what are called little endian, little E-N-D-I-A-N. So the little end comes first. And we'll get back to this in problem set 5. But what this means is that that indeed is a 32-bit integer. And a 32-bit int is like 4 bytes, 4 chunks of 8 bits. But the annoying thing is that the smallest of the bits actually come first instead of actually being at the end on disk. This was just a convention that the world adopted. Networks do it this way. Linux, Intel computers do it this way. Some computers, some CPUs, though, do it the sort of way you would expect. So we'll cover this again in problem set 5, but let's see if a little sanity check holds. So that looks like it's the first board because it's the first set of bits and only the first integer. So I'm going to go ahead and again, let's see. Let's go ahead and quit that. Let's go ahead and rerun Sudoku new, and aha, so that's actually kind of neat. So the very first number in the board is, in fact, a number 2 for precisely that reason. Those were the bits. But this is a detail you don't need to worry about so much, but at least it's something that's kind of neat to bear in mind. So let's actually customize this thing. So I'm going to quit the game. I'm going to go into one of the two files, the easier of the two, that allows me to start getting going with this game. So in sudoku.h, we've used it not to put function prototypes, because we're not writing library here that anyone else in the world is ever going to care to use. So we don't need to create a header file, a .h file, for other people to take advantage of. So rather, we're using the header file this time to put constants, to put all of the configuration for the game in one place, so that if someone wants to recompile the program with some different features, they don't have to go mucking around the C code, which is a pretty big file, but they can focus very specifically on the .h file. And so this is another common use for .h files. The colors here are a little dark, in dark blue here, but notice that we seem to have one, an author string, a constant called author, a constant called title, and a whole bunch of other constants called like FG for foreground banner, BG for background banner, and then these other constants, color cyan, color black, color white, color red. So these are all of the little configuration options. So just to be clear, this was what the game looks like, a red border, a yellow logo, and a white board. Well, let's see if we can just kind of butcher this. So let's change the author first to David Malin. Change Sudoku. Let's just call it My Sudoku. How about version 1.0? And now down here, here are the possible colors that you can use by default, although you can customize them using numeric values if you want. What do you want to choose for the borders instead of red? Audience participation time. Magenta. All right. So let's go. Banners colors. We have a foreground and background. You want that for the background, presumably. So magenta. And then the words inside of it?
Blue.
All right. So that's already sounding kind of ugly. Good. How about the grid? Right now it's black and white. What's that?
What's cyan?
Cyan is like a light blue, I think. Light blue. You want to see? Well, let's do it. Foreground color will be cyan, and background can be black. Otherwise, the board will look really, really ugly. This was the banner, actually. Oh, okay. You know what? Let me fix this. So banner you're not actually going to see because we don't have any messages printing yet. So let me change the border to blue and magenta, and we'll leave the banner alone for now. What about the logo? The logo is all yellow. So if you screw up the backgrounds, let's just invert it. So yellow background and black text. Let's see what this looks like. So let's ignore the rest of the file. There's not much more there. Let's save the file. Let's go into the makefile for a moment. And if you remember the commentary in problem set 3 that explained makefiles, notice that there are two targets in this makefile, one called Sudoku, one called clean. When you just type make by itself at the prompt, which one of these targets gets used? The first one, yep, the top one. So that's why it's just useful to know. This after the colon, what is this saying in English? The fact that I have sudoku.c and sudoku.h there. Yeah. Good, good. So this is specifically the dependencies for the target. So what this means is that make should check the last modification timestamps for those two files. And if either of them has changed since the last time the program has run, what should make presumably do? Rebuild the program. And so this is why a moment ago, when I ran make right after running GCC, make realized, wait a minute, why should I bother recompiling your program? You haven't changed those files in the past few minutes. So this is actually a useful optimization. When your game is pretty small, when your programs are pretty small, really not a big deal to recompile one file because it happens kind of like that. But when your programs get bigger, even Shuttleboy, for instance, which is similarly uses ncurses but has like 12 different files, well, when I first wrote it on nice.fas, like it was not a very fast Linux server, and it would take 20 seconds to compile the whole program. That gets very annoying if you can avoid recompiling files that haven't changed. So make is wonderful for that because it makes sure that it's not doing unnecessary work. And then finally, this is just the copy-paste stuff. So run GCC, use this flag, turn everything into errors, output this file, and specifically compile this file when looking for your main function. And then the clean routine, this is just one of these conventions. It's just nice to be able to delete all the junk that you accumulate based on while running a program, core files, log files, the program itself. So make clean sort of deletes anything that fundamentally isn't important. So it doesn't delete your source code, but it does delete everything else. So let's go ahead and save the .h file, run make. No errors, so that's good. Let's run Sudoku of noob board 0 just for the consistency. And now we have a really hideous game. But at least it's ours, right? Now it's by David Malin, My Sudoku 1.0 by David Malin. But it's hideous. But it at least suggests, oh, and this is cyan for future reference. So feel free to play around with that. I would argue that there's only so many combinations that actually look decent, but at least it's kind of fun to have that flexibility. But the last thing that's of technical interest to us in this .h file is this last thing that we mentioned briefly in lecture today. So enum is this keyword that allows you to enumerate a whole bunch of constants at once and give those constants values, numeric values, that increase by default by plus one. So the way ncurses works, as we'll see when we dive into the C file, is that to turn on colors for the program, you have to specify together a background color and a foreground color. And you have to refer to that background and foreground in terms of a pair. So you define two of them, you somehow associate them, and the means by which you associate them is that you give the pair a numeric ID. By default, one is the first, two is the second, three is the third. But it would be really annoying if hard-coded throughout my program were numbers literally like 1, 2, 3, 4, because then it's up to me, the programmer, to remember, you know, what the heck was the pair number 2? What colors does that correspond to? What was number 3? It's a lot nicer in programming if you can refer to things symbolically. So what this enum line is doing is declaring a constant called pair banner, the pair meant for my banner, whose initial value is, whose value is 1, because otherwise enum start at 0, and ncurses expects number 1 for the first color pair. After that, it's just plus plus automatically. So then I have my grid, so the crossbars and all the dots. I wanted to just give them a foreground and background color, so I call that pair grid. I wanted another pair of colors for the border, so I created a constant called pair border, and another pair of colors for the logo called pair logo. Could have called them anything I wanted, but this at least is consistent. It's all capitalized. It's pretty clear what these things mean. So a quick sanity check. What is the numeric value of pair logo? 4. Right? So this is just like, to be clear, doing something like this using old tricks. I could also have said define pair banner 1. Define pair grid 2. Define pair, so it very quickly gets tedious. Plus, if just to be anal, you like to alphabetize things or you like to cluster some of these constants together for conceptual reasons and you decide to add a new pair, well, you have to manually like renumber everything with this approach, which is just a pain. It takes time, it's a waste of time. And so enums allow you to automate, in a sense, some of this process by just listing them out, and the compiler will take care of assigning them all numbers. But you do have the ability to assign one by default, the first one. Or you can actually, if you really care, if you only want odd numbers, you can do this. Still saves you a bit of syntax, but it's not quite the point of using enums. But you can do that. Okay, so I've hit undo a whole bunch of times so that I've restored this file to its original configuration. I remade my program, and we're at least back to something that's a little more readable. So that's Sudoku.h. Any questions? No? Need a candy break? Yes? No? All right, well, Bucket has disappeared beneath someone's chair, but there we go. All right, so let's forge ahead with Sudoku.c, which is the last file, but it's kind of the biggest one. So what's the best thing to bear in mind here? Well, let's flip back to the PDF for a second. This part of the PDF, again, really was just holding your hand, so to speak, through some of this, right? There's a lot to be said, I think, frankly, for just getting comfortable with what you've been handed just by playing with the colors, looking through the variables, because at least me, mentally, once I sort of understand every line in the file, like, it's a lot less of a big deal, because at least now I know what world I'm about to play in. So the same goes for Sudoku.c. So the PDF spends a long time walking you through a lot of the C file, because the best thing you can do with this problem set is start not by trying to write code, not by thinking about how you're going to design the program, but read through the code. Not only Sudoku.h, which maybe is actually pretty easy now, but Sudoku.c, so that you know this code as well, or almost as well as, say, I do, who actually wrote it. Because if you understand exactly how the code works, you're going to know instinctively where you should start adding lines of your own. You're going to know how you can change the behavior of the program, because you already understand how it works. And mark my word, if you take the approach of just trying to cut corners by, ugh, that's a lot of code, I'm not going to bother trying to figure it all out now, you're just going to waste time trying to figure it out later. The best thing you can do is curl up with Sudoku.c, both here today, which is a good start, and then after today, presumably, get comfortable with it, and then dive in to the part of the problems that you need to implement. And it will make your life so, so much easier. So let's start walking you through some of this code now, so you needn't do it entirely on your own. So this is sudoku.c. Notice the very first real line of code, I'm including my own header file, so that's a good thing. All of these things, we've seen most of these files before. The reason they're here is for reasons that I realized while coding the file. So I didn't know the first time I sat down to write the program that I'm going to need ctype.h or signal.h or standardbool.h. These are the kinds of things as you write large software programs, you just realize, oh, I need to go add another include file. I need another one because the man page tells you to. If you realize you need some function from like the math library, you got to go add math.h if you realize this much. So when writing your own programs, don't really sit down and think, like, what libraries am I going to need, except for the obvious ones. Like, ncurses, you pretty much know in advance you're going to need it, put it there. But otherwise, you'll get yelled at by the compiler if you've not included some file that you do, in fact, need. So those are the includes. The one thing, or the first thing that the problem set walks you through is this new feature. So all this time, we've been using define, sharp define, to define constants. Well, it turns out you can define what are called macros, too. And this is something I mentioned in lecture this afternoon. A macro is like a mini function that appears to take arguments, but it's not really a function because it doesn't do all that stuff with the stack. It doesn't allocate memory and stack frames. It doesn't then tear it down. It's a lot more efficient because what a macro literally is a copy-paste. So what this macro is saying is that I can type CTRL and then in parentheses some value. And what the compiler is going to do when my program is built is it's going to change all instances of CTRL with a number in parentheses to something that looks a little weirder but useful, this. So a macro is, again, this sort of way of cleaning up your code by taking something that you really don't need a whole function for because it does such a simple task. And in this case, the simple task that this does, and we'll come into this, come back to this later in the course, is this funkiness with the x, ampersand, the tilde, and then the number. This is doing what's called bitwise operations. So for characters like control C, control Q, control L, any control characters, they don't always have numbers that are as nice as 65 for A and 66 for B. They're bigger numbers, and so, or sometimes they're multiple numbers because they're special control characters. It's like the control number than the character you typed. So for ncurses, this macro is a neat trick for converting what are control characters into very simple values, single numbers, not multiple numbers. So you don't have to you don't have to understand how this is working, but just know that it's allowing you to detect things like control L when the user wants to refresh the screen. Or if you actually want to support some feature, like a special feature that's control whatever, well, this is how you detect control as opposed to just the letter. So the next thing that's new here, and we'll come actually back to on Wednesday in lecture, is this thing called a struct. It's not really all that hard. A struct is a structure, and it's a way of wrapping a whole bunch of conceptually related variables together so that you can give them one collective name and deal with them sort of all at once rather than passing them all around individually. So we decided for this program that we're going to need a bunch of global variables. One, a string that describes the level the user's playing, noob or elite. So a string these days is just a char star. Okay, we're not using the CS50 library anymore. Those training wheels are off. So a board. So the board is an 81-character board. So that's 9 by 9. And so just like Game of 15, we have a global variable called board. It's a little bigger. Normally, you don't hard code numbers into programs, right? That's kind of frowned upon, we've said. But the only place we ever say 9 by 9 is here. In the game, we don't want it to ever change. So it's reasonable to just hard code those values, we would argue. The board's number. So this is going to be a value from like 0 to 1023. We want to keep track of what game the user is playing. We also decided through trial and error or some design decisions that we need to keep track of the coordinates, the XY coordinates, of the top left corner of the grid, like of the board. And why might we care about remembering those coordinates? Yeah, it's pretty much for that resizing reason. If the user blows up the window, we want them to keep playing. We could have cut corners and just said, quit, you shouldn't have done that. But it's sort of more sophisticated to deal with that yourself programmatically. But if they do that, the board, remember, is going to resize itself to put the game board still in the middle of the screen. And I can't simulate it because of the resolution of this thing. But try it at home. Blow up the window as big as you can, and the game will still stay centered. But the implication of that is that the coordinates of the board change. Because we'll see in a moment, the top left corner of your cursor's window is 0, 0. And then the bottom is something like 79, 23. So you have an XY grid, a Cartesian plane essentially, with 0, 0 as the top left corner. That means that the board itself, the grid as it moves around, is going to have different coordinates. And we need to remember that, otherwise we're going to be plopping numbers in completely the wrong place on the screen. We have to remember one coordinate. We don't need all of them, because we know the thing's 9 by 9. So it suffices just to remember the top left, the top right, the whatever corner. And you can figure the rest out arithmetically. All right, so the last thing we decided we need to keep track of is x and y, or in ncurses speak, y, x. So in every other context in your lives, you probably always said x, y. The following week, you're going to be using y, x, because that is the ncurses convention. So we needed a way of keeping track of where the user's cursor is, because that's because we want them to be able to go up, down, left, right. But the thing is, anytime you update a screen using ncurses, you're actually using the cursor itself to go update that part of the screen. So it's kind of like a paintbrush. If you want to update, for instance, the timer in the bottom right-hand corner, you have to move the blinking prompt to the bottom corner, change the text there, and then quickly refresh the screen. Now, nothing else has changed, but it's like moving your paintbrush really quickly down here. But the problem is, if you just leave your cursor, leave the paintbrush down here, well, the user's in the middle of trying to play a game. Like, you can't just take it away and put it there, otherwise the next number is going to end up down here. And the user's going to go up, down, left, right, and they're going to be over here instead of over here. So because we're using the cursor as a user interface mechanism, but also to paint the screen constantly, we need to remember where it should be. And so we do that by way of y, x. Now, this last thing here after the curly brace is the name we're giving to this whole structure. So henceforth, anytime we want to access these global variables, what we're going to do is not write the name of the variable alone, but we're going to very simply write g dot, for instance, board. So for problem set 3, you just said board. In any of your functions, when you wanted to touch the global variable called board, in this problem set, because we've grouped these related variables together into a variable very simply called g for game or global, think of it however you want, you just do g dot global variable name. And we'll soon see in a week or so's time that there's other syntax for pointers, namely, we'll also eventually see an arrow operator like this, followed by the name of some variable, but that's not yet applicable to this problem set. But if you've seen that syntax before, it will come up again. So any questions on macros or on structs?
Why do you have a G?
So the G is the name of this thing. Because I want to be able now to access all of these variables from any function. So I'm going to do it by way of whatever I wrote here, G dot variable name. I could have called this variables or vars or whatever, but g is just succinct and it's sort of the only. Normally, you know, we tell you not to use x and y, but here it makes sense for coordinates. These are global variables for the whole game. G is pretty reasonable, just keeps it succinct. But it's arbitrary. Okay, so let's take a look now at the main routine. All right, so first, function prototypes that we're handing you. It's not obvious necessarily when you sit down to write the program the first time what functions you need. So this was some of my laundry list as I realized, oh, I should kind of write a new function for this. I'd implement it, go put its prototype up top, and this list would just gradually get longer. But lest you be thinking that writing large software means being really smart and knowing what you need before you even code it up, not necessarily. You kind of figure things out iteratively, certainly when you're starting off. So let's focus on main for now. So it looks like main operates as follows. First, because I wanted to print it a whole bunch of times in different error conditions, I defined a string, aka char star, that just specifies how this game is supposed to be played. So that's pretty old hat. These next two lines here, or these next few lines here, are requiring that the number of command line arguments passed to my program be what? 2, or really 1 and 2, depending on the semantics here, because what's in argv of 0? What's stored at argv0? Yeah, the name of the program. So if you really think about arguments as everything after, argc2 means there was one argument given to the program, and argc3 means there were two. So I just decided that I only want the user to be able to type, and want them to be able to type at least one argument, noob or leet, but the thing in brackets, the number was meant to be optional. Okay, so I do that little sanity check. Now I need to figure out, assuming the user passes that test, what level they actually want to play. So per today's lecture, where we use something like strcomp or strncomp, what I'm doing is comparing argv of 1 to the string noob, and if that is in fact what the user typed in, I'm storing in the global variable called level the string noob, just so that I remember what file, what level it is the user actually wants to play. And here, too, there's a design decision. I've clearly hard-coded the string noob into the program, and generally it's not that great to hard-code anything again and again. But here, too, this is the only place in the program where I specified N-O-O-B. It's isolated to a couple lines of code. Seemed like it was just adding complexity to define a constant at the top and then use that constant. So I made a judgment call and said, you know what? It's such a brief use of some constant. It's just hard-coded into the program because it's never going to change, at least in my vision for this game. So if that is strcomp returns what if two strings are equal? It returns an int. That's your hint. So what does it return if two strings are equal? OK, you've clearly forgotten. Well, how would you check? How would you find that out besides emailing your TF? Well, yeah, the manual. So man strcomp. All right, so let's do that. All right, so man, oh, come on. OK, man str compare. OK, it looks like it, yep, it returns an int. Scroll down, return value. The strcomp function returns an integer less than, equal to, or greater than 0 if s1 is found, respectively, to be less than, to match, or to be greater than s2. So it's the middle thing that we care about. It returns 0 if the strings match. So what I'm doing here, then, is doing this bang operator, not. So if not strcomp, that's like saying if the strings are equal, go ahead and assign the global variable called level noob. Otherwise, if the variable equals leet, remember leet, otherwise the user screwed up. So go ahead and print out the usage message, return to, and let the user try again. And this per lecture today is one of those separate streams. So even though aesthetically for our purposes right now doesn't really make a difference whether you use printf or fprintf with standard error, or fprintf with standard out, it's at least a good habit now to get into. As the programs get more sophisticated, best to follow conventions, even if right now it's not really obvious why you need to, because it doesn't have any visual effect. All right, so let's finish our error checking. So ensure that the number, if provided, is in this range, from 0 inclusive to 1024 exclusive, just some syntax that people use. So if argc equals equals 3, so if the user actually typed in that optional argument, let's go ahead and So this was a trick from lecture today. So remember that you can use A to I to convert an ASCII string to a number, but there's a problem with it, at least if you're trying to do rigorous error checking, which is what? The goal here is to make sure the user only types in a number. Why does A to I leave us vulnerable to bugs? It only takes the beginning part. Not exactly. There's another problem with it.
Yeah. Is it bad if you give it a word that just returns 0?
Yeah. So if you give it something that's just not a number, like foo or David, it doesn't choke and give you some kind of error. It just returns 0, which means you can't distinguish the user having typed in 0 or having typed in some bogus value altogether. So it's OK. So now our programs need to get more sophisticated. So it turns out there's this function called scanf, string scan function. And what that does, or form, f stands for format string, generally. So I'm going to scan argv of 2, the optional number that the user typed in. I'm going to use this special format string. And this was the trick I mentioned in lecture for, we really want to check for a digit. But if case the user typed in some garbage as well, we're going to try to match on that as well. Because if they did, that garbage is going to end up in this variable, which we can then detect. And so we insert ampersand g dot number. So it's a little weird looking, but g is the global struct. Dot number means go get the global variable called number in that struct. And why do I use the ampersand? Yeah, because scanf, it wants to change the variable. It wants to dump whatever the user typed in into that variable. So I need to pass it by reference. C, I also need to pass by reference, but it's really just a junky variable I need briefly. It's a temporary variable. But I really want scanf to return 1. Because if scanf returns 1, it means the user only provided this, the decimal number, which is great because that's all I cared about. But if it returns anything other than 1, like 0, nothing matched, or 2, they typed too much stuff, I can detect that and yell at the user by printing the usage. So we're about to run out of tape, so why don't we take a 2-minute candy break and then resume. All right, we are back. So where we left off is a whole bunch of error checking. So hopefully none of it that hard. There's definitely some new tricks there, right? Like the scanf tricks and the global struct, but nothing that's all that complicated once you sort of accept how it works. So let's look at the last check that we actually do here. So after I go about scanning argv of 2 and reading in that optional number, this is a very easy thing to understand, right? If g.number is less than 0 or it's greater than 1023, we'll yell at the user again because we only have 1,024 boards. They can't pick something out of range. Just yell at them. All right, so once we pass that check, now we're actually going to use this number. So recall from problem set 2, you had to implement or use that pseudo-random number generator for your sorting function. And what did it mean to seed, S-E-E-D, a P-R-N-G, pseudo-random number generator? What did that mean? Yeah. Yeah, so with the current time. And that's not a fixed rule, but people do tend to use the time because the catch with a pseudo random number generator is that it's not actually random because a computer can't just think of a number off the top of its head, but you can at least feed it something that's at least changing all the time, like the current time. And so we use this srand function passing in the return value of the time function, which if you look at the man page, not only returns the current time as an integer, the number of seconds from like January 1st, 1970, it can also take a variable by reference just because that you can then store the current time in that variable as well. If you don't care about that, the convention is just to pass in null to time's argument, and its return value is, again, the time, number of seconds from January 1, 1970. And that gives us some pseudo-randomness. Now, the reason we did this is so that we get any sequence of numbers that we get a different sequence of numbers every time we play the game. But there was one thing we wanted to ensure. So the reason we're seeding the PRNG if the user actually types in a board number is just to facilitate debugging, whereby it's kind of nice if the program behaves the same way every time you run it. Well, this line here, that whereby we seed the pseudo-random number generator, not with the current time, but with the actual number the user typed in. That means if the user plays the first game that they get, like 42, if they type in the hard-coded value 42, and then they hit new game, they're going to get another pseudo-random board, but the same one again and again and again if they rerun the program at different times of the day. And this is, again, just so that you guys can sort of don't have to bang your heads against the wall hoping that the same game is going to come up again. The game will be played deterministically. So just kind of a useful trick. But it's stuff from problem set 2. So finally, we do this. g.number equals rand percent 1024. So if we want to generate a brand new board because the user didn't type in a number, because, again, it was optional, why do I do this modulo 1024? Yeah, exactly. So rand, if you look at the man page, returns a number from like 0 to a really huge int. Kind of a problem if we've only got 1,024 boards. So the modulo makes sure we wrap around and stay within that safe range. So yet another useful, if simple, use for the modulo operator. So now we actually start to do real work. So here's where, when I started writing this code, I realized, you know what, there's a whole bunch of functions I need to call to get ncurses started. It's going to make my main function really long if I just put them all in main. So I factored them out. And I said, it's the process required to start up the game. So I'm going to call the function startup. And I'm going to have it return a bool. It's going to return true if everything went great and ncurses is up and running and everything works. It's going to return false if anything goes wrong. Because now, in my main function, I just check if not startup. So if startup returns false, what do I do? Just bail, right? Inform the user that error starting up ncurses, quit, and forget about it. Don't try to figure out what went wrong exactly. We're trying to keep the game simple, but we clearly can't move ahead if ncurses itself didn't start up. So some good error handling there. And I'm returning 6 really just because. So I'm never actually going to use these return values in all these erroneous conditions. But again, it's a good convention to get into. Because if you're really getting into debugging a big program, you, the programmer, really do want to know what error happened that killed the program. And so returning a unique non-zero number is sort of the convention the world has adopted. All right, so let's accept for now, let's not even look at these functions, accept for now that in this function called startup, there's a whole bunch of lines of code that start ncurses. Just accept that that's how it works. So now we can sort of move on. So this is a somewhat neat piece of code that you don't need to understand for the problem set, but it's this line of code that informs the operating system, hey, we care about the user resizing their window, and if the user does resize their window, please call the function called handle signal, which is the function I wrote. So it's in that function, handle signal, where there's some lines of code that do all the recentering, the fixing of the screen if the user resizes their window. So it's what's called a signal. And a handler, in general, is a function that handles something that's happened outside your control. So again, this is our way of telling the operating system in advance, hey, if the user double-clicks their taskbar, or clicks and drags, and makes the thing bigger, please inform me about it so that the game doesn't get all messed up. So there's a function in here called handleSignal. Okay, so starting the first game, I reduced to 2 function calls, restart the game. And even though I'm starting the game, I called the function restartGame just because I can then reuse it for that same resetGame option or restartGame option. And then I have this function called redrawAll. So I decided it would kind of keep me sane, and hopefully us in the class, if I model different parts of the board with different functions. So we'll see there's a function called drawBorders. There's one called drawGrid. There's one called drawLogo. So the conceptually distinct parts of the screen, I wrote separate functions to draw them. But then I wrote one big function that just calls all those smaller functions to redraw everything all at once. So to start this game, we need to start ncurses, register the signal handler so we can deal with aesthetic resizings of the window. We want to restart the game, whatever that means for now, and then redraw everything. And at this point in the story, right before this do while loop, the game is good to go. The whole board is set up. So what's probably inside of this do while loop? What kind of functionality? What was in the do while loop just conceptually for game of 15? Yeah. Yeah, so moving around the numbers, right? The do while loop existed so that we intentionally listened forever for user input. So it's inside this do while loop where it's actually going to be where we, every time the user makes a move, we redraw part of the screen, we refresh the screen as needed so that we see the change, and we're listening for a character, whether it's up, down, left, right, a number, or whatever. So let's see what's going on in there. So per lecture today, we're not going to try to get a char, because if the user can technically provide any number of any of 256 characters, kind of hard to detect an error condition. So the world generally uses an int so that you have also a huge number of possible error codes that you can detect as well. So we'll see why this is useful in a second. So let's scroll down. So the do while loop here does a few things. So the first thing it does is it refreshes the screen, because I decided that every time the user makes a move, I'm probably going to need to redraw the screen. Because the way ncurses works is it lets you modify a character at a specific coordinate, but the user does not see the change until the refresh function is called. And this is for efficiency reasons. The idea is that, especially when terminals, when internet connections were really slow back in the day, you can make a whole bunch of changes sort of behind the scenes to this grid that is your screen, 80 characters by 24, and then all at once do you display those changes rather than one at a time. And it was an efficiency thing. So you have to manually call refresh, which we do. You don't have to do it, but we need to do it again and again every time a change is made. All right, what's next? This neat function here, getchar, getch, this also, just like refresh, comes with the ncurses library. So these are not functions you get for free out of the box with C. We had to include, sharp include, ncurses.h and link with dash l ncurses. But this just waits for 1,000 milliseconds for a character from the user. So it kind of puts the program to sleep just waiting for user input, and hopefully within that second, that 1,000 milliseconds, the user will have typed a character. If not, we'll see what happens. Now, just to keep things simple, I decided to force all input to uppercase, because this way I don't need two case statements, uppercase L, lowercase L. I can just have one by forcing everything to uppercase. And now I have a switch. So here we have a pretty compelling use for a switch construct, because it just keeps our code pretty clean. So the first case I wanted to handle is if the user typed in an N, lowercase or uppercase, but I only have to check for uppercase, because again, I capitalized their input. If the user did type in N for new game, well, the first thing I decided I needed to do was pick a new game board, a new number for it, using the rand function and the modulo trick. Then I needed to restart the game, because I designed that function in such a way to look at this variable, g.number, for the board that's supposed to be loaded into memory. And that's all. If the user instead typed in an R, I want to run the function called restart game, whatever that does. And that's it. Notice that I did include break. So without break, everything below this line here would get executed. So if you left out this break, left out this break, and left out this break, and the first case that matches, for instance, capital N, means everything below it gets executed until it sees a break. So these breaks are necessary when you add your own cases starting this week. So we have this other one just because most programs in Linux, when you hit Control L, it redraws the screen. If you got like some kind of funky instant message from someone or some warning from the administrator of the machine, Control L by convention clears the screen. So to mimic that same convention, we have this function called redraw all. And we use this match grow, control, followed by an L, to actually let the user hit control L to refresh the screen. It's kind of like a hidden keystroke. It's not documented in the interface, but it does work. Okay, finally, we've got this. So that's it. That's the do while loop. The last line of code inside the loop is this. If ch does not equal error, that is, if the user actually typed a legit character, log what just happened. So this is something you can turn a blind eye to, but so that we can automate certain tests of your code, we have this function that just logs what the user just typed in, and it logs what the board game looks like so that we can make sure that you're responding to users' input correctly. So just know that that is there and needs to stay there. But under what circumstances might ch be error? Well, again, for efficiency reasons, and so that your program is not waiting forever for user input that might not ever come, getchar, getch, only waits for 1,000 milliseconds at a time. And if after 1 second the user hasn't typed in anything, the function does still return, but it returns what constant? ERR, error. So nothing came through. So this is useful because ERR, is it going to match any of the cases I've defined? No, so this means that nothing happens with that. But because we're inside of a do while loop, what happens next? We go back to the start of the do loop, we refresh the screen, we wait another second for another character. So the mere reason for this is so that your program doesn't get stuck in a loop just in case there is some input, there is some other line of code that really should execute. For instance, maybe the game should quit. If the user disappears for 5 minutes, it'd be nice if we can detect that and say, forget this, your game is over. Right, especially if you have a time limit for the game. You don't want the user to not touch the screen and then get sort of free minutes because they're not actually doing anything. So that's all. This function, getchar, waits for a second maximally for the user's input. If you get nothing, though, we just get another iteration out of it. Okay? And this goes on forever until what happens? According to this line here, when do we break out of this do while loop? Yep. Exactly. Right. So this loop runs again and again until the ch variable contains the uppercase, because we forced it to be, q, in which case the loop stops. And what happens then? Apparently there's a function called shutdown, which apparently cleans up the whole ncurses environment. These are these funky ANSI escape sequences from problem set 3 that just have the effect of erasing the whole screen in a non-ncurses specific way. And then we print this silly k thanks bye before returning 0 to signify success. So one of the best takeaways, frankly, from this is that even though there is a bunch of code that we've given you, the best way to start this program and others is just read through the main routine, accept, or maybe look at the comments for the functions being called, what they do. And if you sort of accept that those functions do what they say, you can sort of very quickly move through the rest of the function and have a sense of how the whole program works. And now, if you're interested at this point in sort of bringing yourself up to speed, you can decide, all right, which of those functions do I now care to learn a little more about? What would benefit me at this point? Well, let's ask ourselves the question before we even look at any of those functions. If my goal, among my first goals, is to implement support for moving the cursor up, down, left, right, propose to me where you might focus your attention in the first, you know, hour or so of working on the problem set for where you want to put lines of code. Where might you want to put some stuff? Yeah, in the do while loop, right? So there's already a infrastructure there for waiting for user input. It only understands N for new game, R for restart game, and control L and Q, but we need to understand up, down, left, and right as well. Now, I don't know how you're going to move the cursor just yet, but we at least know we need to have something in there. So if I scroll down to that point, you'll notice when you read through the PDF that we do tell you that there are certain special constants that exist in ncurses. Specifically, there's a constant called key up, which represents the up arrow. There's a case key down, which is the down arrow, and you can imagine key left and key right. So the way that I'm going to check the up arrow is by having a case key up, and then I'm going to need to move cursor up one character. Now, I don't know how to do that yet, but once I do, I'm going to break. And then below the key down case, I'm going to move the cursor down one char and then break. And then, just to communicate the idea, dot, dot, dot. Now, what would be nice here is probably maybe we could have a function like move down, right? And now I can get rid of my pseudocode comment. And what do I have to do next, presumably? I need to make some room and down in the file and implement a function called move down. Now, how am I going to move the cursor down? Well, let's see if we can figure out what kinds of code, what kind of ncurses functions would be useful here. So let's scroll up to our function prototypes. Let's see. Looks like there's functions called draw board. You know what? How about draw grid? That's kind of the most... Actually, let's do draw borders. It's even simpler. So the borders are pretty simple. They're two lines at the very top and the very bottom. We should be able to learn some tricks that way. So let's go to draw borders. Whoops. Draw borders, and here's this function. So there's not all that much to it, but let's take a look. So the first couple lines of code declare a variable called max x, a max y, and max x. And the first call here is actually to a macro that comes with ncurses. And to be clear and to reassure you, the PDF repeats this kind of information. We're calling get max x y on the standard screen. So std scr is the keyword that you use to describe the default screen. Cursors, as an aside, lets you separate different parts of the screen into different windows, so to speak. We're just using one big window that fills the screen, and its nickname is standard screen, STD-SCR. So what do I pass in? I pass in this variable max y. I pass in this variable max x. And what that's going to do, this macro that again comes with ncurses, is it's going to drop two integers into those variables, max x and max y, specifically the width of the screen and the height of the screen. So ideally, if this this macro works as advertised, the number that's going to end up in max y is going to be 23, because if the top left is 0, 0, y, comma, x, and it's 24 characters high, that means the maximum y going downward is 23 characters later, whereas max x is going to be, oh, close, 79, because maximum x is going to be all the way over here, 79. At the 79th coordinate. Okay, so now what else happens? So it turns out ncurses has a function called hasColors that returns a Boolean value, true or false, if the user's terminal program, their SSH program, supports color, yes or no. If so, we're going to turn on an attribute. So there's this function called atterOn, attribute on, that takes the value of a function, a macro called color pair, and you just have to know this by reading the man page, and you pass to this macro color pair the constant that we defined where? So in Sudoku.h. So whatever pair border was, I think it was black foreground and red background, we called it pair border. That was its special enumed value. All this line of code here is doing with atteron is it's telling ncurses, turn on that foreground-background scheme. So it's, if you've ever used Photoshop, it's like saying turn the background color to red, the foreground color to black or white or whatever it was, and get ready to use that color. Get ready to use that color in your paintbrush. Because the next line of code does this, draw borders. And this is where the magic happens. And these are among the few functions you need to know in endcurse to actually make pretty things appear on the screen. So I have a for loop that iterates from 0 to max x. So all the way from left to right. What am I going to do? I'm going to add to y, comma x. So y is going to equal 0. So that means the top row of the screen. Comma I, so that value is going to change from 0 all the way up to 79. What am I going to print according to what's here? Just a space, it seems. Meanwhile, in the same loop, I want to print at location max y dot minus 1, which is going to be... Yeah, and actually, you know what? Max x, I lied. So it doesn't return 23 and 79. It actually returns 24 and 80. So sorry, I was off by 1. So now, because I'm saying move to max y, comma 1, that's saying move to location 23, comma I, so from 0 to 79, print also a white space there, or a blank space there. Now, what do these functions do? MV means move the cursor. Add ch means add a character. So these functions, together with their three arguments, move the cursor to a y, comma x location and plant a specific character there. And the reason I'm just planting spaces is I pretty much just want the illusion of a border. All red just means I hit the space bar 80 times, essentially, with a red background color and whatever white foreground color, in this case white. So that has the effect of printing these borders, but then I want to plant the logo on top of it. So the other most important function, so far as our game interface goes, is the following. First, I have a little trick here with the printf function, which I'll wave my hands at. But assume for now, at this point in my code, I have a string that says Sudoku by David Malin in a string called header. Well, this function is sort of the string version of mvAddCharacter. So just as you can add a single character to a coordinate, you can also drop down an entire string. So if that string's variable name is called header, what I'm doing with this line of code is saying move this string to y equals 0, so the top row in my screen. And now this is some simple arithmetic. Take the width of the screen, max x, minus the length of the header, divide by 2. And if you think that through at home, that's just figuring out how you center a string of some length. Right? You plant it roughly halfway in the middle and then shift it to the left so that it's perfectly centered. I just figured out what the simple arithmetic should be. What do you plant there? Well, this string here. What about this footer? Well, I decided arbitrarily that I wanted new game to appear almost in the left-hand corner, but one space over. So I wrote, call the mvAddString function here. mvAddString, put it at max y minus 1, which is the bottommost row, put it one character over at x equals 1, and then literally plant this string on top of whatever happens to be there already. In that case, the whole bunch of characters. So there's two really important functions here. One drops down an individual character, one drops down a whole string, and with those basic building blocks, can you overlay on your canvas, so to speak, pretty much anything, whether it's a number or a whole string, but because these MV functions are moving the cursor around, somewhere in our code are we actually going to have to move the cursor back. And so the means by which we did this is this function called showCursor, and you'll notice that in this function called redrawAll and elsewhere, do we call this function showCursor? And let's just quickly take a look at what it does. Here's the function. Doesn't do much at all. And it's a little crazy looking. But you can also move your cursor without drawing anything, without adding characters, without adding strings. Just move. And the function is M-O-V-E. And now, cryptic though this seems, all I'm drawing on is I'm using g.top, which is the top left coordinate of the grid. I'm using g.left, which is the left-hand coordinate. And what was g.y and g.x? That was the coordinates of what? So the cursor within a 9 by 9 grid. Because remember, what was one of our global variables? It was the board, right, which was 9 by 9. And then there was the y, x coordinate. So the grid itself is bigger than 81k characters. It's bigger than 9 by 9 because we have those crossbars and we have some white space to make things look more square than a scrunched up rectangle. So we have to sort of map a 9 by 9 grid onto something that's a little larger just for aesthetic purposes. So after some careful thought, I figured out that this little trickery, dividing by 3, the 3 relates to the fact that we have 3 big columns in there, but you can figure it out by trial and error. This just moves the cursor to whatever location is appropriate given its position in the board array, the 9 by 9, but on top of the grid, which happens to be a little larger. So what then remains for you guys to do? Well, what the PDF ultimately challenges you to do after walking you through, and the PDF does do this, rest assured, it walks you through more of these functions at a slower pace, you have to implement a number of required features. So one required feature, and the first and most important, is to get the cursor unstuck. So to really finish where we started off verbally, figure out where do you put the code that handles cursor movements. Well, it looks like it's in the do while loop. Well, you have to then have a function like move down or move up or call it whatever you want. But now you have to figure out how do you actually move the cursor. Well, you kind of have the seeds of that idea already elsewhere in the program, right? You have to move it to some location mathematically. Well, maybe that's not all that hard. Well, once you have up, down, left, right working within the bounds of the grid, it looks like the second requirement that's required is to enable the user to replace any blank space with a number by moving his or her cursor to that blank and then hitting a number. So apparently you're going to have something in your switch statement that handles integers from 1 to 9, and then also we see later the delete key or the zero key or the period. So we decided just to be user friendly, we want to support a whole bunch of ways for undoing what the user did, hit delete, hit backspace, hit period, hit zero. All of them should be handled the same. Doesn't mean you have to write 4 functions, just means you have to have like 4 cases, all of which are the same. Finally, you need to check, or second to last, you need to check obviously that the user, if the user has won the game. And so you can think through some fairly simple heuristics, right? You've got a grid that's 9 by 9. The simplest way is probably start from left to right, left to right, left to right, then check all the columns, then check all the boxes. Maybe there's a fancier way of doing it that's a little less efficient, but that's probably okay. Gets the job done correctly. And then lastly, you need to check also if the user has done something stupid. So if the user tries to fill a 3x3 box with all 9s, you, the program, can clearly detect that and warn the user, this is just not possible. And so the last requirement is that you check, you do sanity checks for the user. If they've done something that's obviously wrong because they violated the row or the column or the 3x3 box constraint, there's a function that we give you in the distribution code called showBanner. And you can actually show a nice little cyan banner in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen automatically. We gave you that code as well. And then you have some discretion. So once the game is working, we came up with a list of fairly bite-sized additional features that it's up to you to pick one of them. So among them are the feature whereby all of the numbers on the screen could go green when the game has been won. Just to make clear, ta-da, you've won the game. Another feature is to implement the timer that we showed you. And there's a time function you used, recall, in problem set 2. So you've seen that seed of an idea before. One other feature is to show all of the numbers that come with the board in a different color from the numbers the user, him or herself, are inputting, just for clarity's sake, as to which numbers they can change. And there's a few other menu options you can choose from there. So we hope you'll have great fun with it, frankly. But do, when sitting down at home with it, don't dive in just yet. Do read through the PDF, let it walk yourself through the code, understand Sudoku.c, and then dive in. And I actually think you'll find it to be far more fun than anything laborious, and you'll have a working game as a result. So if you have any questions, why don't I duck off to the side and answer them, since there's another class coming in a moment. Otherwise, we'll see you on Wednesday.